This is the ERP Organizational Change Journal podcast, brought to you by Nestle and Associates, a Newport Beach, California-based ERP organizational change management firm serving the private equity industry. The ERP OCJ seeks to share expertise, insight, experience, and research, and to create effective conversation to help guide ERP organizational change to real, measurable, and verified success. And now, here's your co-host Jonathan Donald, founder of the change management firm Invert Ventures, and your ERP expert and host, the founder of Nestle & Associates, Dr. Jack Nestle.
So in this episode, we will further explore digital transformation technologies, leadership, and challenges. While our guest focuses on oil and gas industry, his insight and experience applies across all industries. Jeffrey, anyone who reads your work will understand why I say this, but as a premier thought leader in oil and gas digital transformation, and as someone who is also passionate about ensuring that technology works for businesses, as someone who is fervent about creating healthy and vibrant organizations through technology, welcome to the show. We are excited to have you.
I'm delighted to be here, and I appreciate the introduction.
All right. Well, hey, let's dive in, Jeffrey. My first question for you is, you state that, quote, your success in the future will be based on how well you adapt and integrate digital innovation into your business. You go on to say a great point is that investors expect it and talent is attracted by it, end quote. This statement to me, Jeffrey, is almost a mandate for a business to stay on top of a digital change and innovation. So why do you say this? Can you provide our listeners with the importance and value of understanding the business case for successful digital transformations?
Well, I believe if you go to capital markets today, and but at, you know, New York or Wall Street or any of the other capital venues around the planet, you're going to get asked two questions at your pitch meeting. And first question is, how are you responding to the ESG agenda? And number two, how are you coping with technology-driven change? And you have to have a really clear answer to these two questions. And so investors do expect it. If you look at, in my research, I looked at market capitalization and revenue profiles for the industrial leaders over a 15-year time window. And if you go back to 2002, the largest company in the world by market cap was Microsoft, but it was followed by ExxonMobil. If you looked at revenue in 2002, the largest revenue company was Walmart, number two, ExxonMobil. Let's forward to 2019, the largest company in the world, depending on day of the week, because they trade places. But it'll be a digital company of some kind. It could be Microsoft or Amazon or Apple or whoever, but it's going to be a digital player. And there are no energy companies now in the top 10 largest companies in the world by market cap. If you look at revenue, however, the largest company in the world in 2019 was Walmart still. But right after that is Sinopec, big Chinese oil company, then Shell, Royal Dutch Shell Group out of Europe, then PetroChina, and after that, State Grid. This industry, the energy industry is revenue rich and therefore cash flow strong. But what you look at what investors want, they're looking at these digital companies. It is very clear. Energy companies in particular, oil and gas for sure, consumes capital at a great pace every year to keep pace with demand. And the market's clearly signaling, you know, if you want to, you're going to have to embrace a digital story if you're going to get access to capital. And you need a really strong ESG story so that you can attract talent. Let's kind of close that off. If you look at millennial investors now, 40% of millennials who have investments say that ESG commitment is extremely important to them. They'll take a pay cut to work for a company that has a strong responsible management. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. If you talk to baby boomers, 17% would say the same thing.
Oh, interesting.
Jeffrey, I'm thinking about revenue rich. I mean, ExxonMobil was delisted from the Dow this year. So that 2002-2019 comparison is so apt right now.
Yes, and every day there's new announcements. Larry Fink, who is the CEO of BlackRock, may have trillions of dollars under management, was in the media this morning or yesterday with a clear message to companies that wish to tap into their capital pool. You better have a story to tell on these two fronts, or you will struggle to get cash for your business. It's really critical.
It really is, and it's such the cutting edge, both the ESG side and the digital transformation side. I want to dig a little deeper on the digital transformation side with you, because that phrase is so different depending on who you talk to. And I find it so easy to say digital transformation and yet mean so many different things. So can you provide us and our listeners some context about what you mean when you say digital? And what does that really look like to you, both in scale, scope, and usage?
Well, you're quite right that it is a confusing term. When I was putting the book together on this topic, this was chapter one, putting a definition to the terminology.
Yeah.
Everywhere I went, I found, consultancies, hardware companies, software firms, governments, regulators, all had a definition of digital, but they're all slightly, if I could say, slightly biased, because depending on what your commercial interests, you might be motivated. Some of these companies are definitely motivated to position digital and digital transformation to suit their agendas.
Sure.
And so the big four firms, Deloitte, PwC, EY, KPMG, and I used to be a partner at Deloitte, so I'm on solid ground when I tell you this. These big firms survive by selling big transformation jobs. So guess what? Their digital definition aims towards big transformation agendas because that's how they make money. So I began my research was to look under the covers to say, okay, let's find the definition that appears to be least corrupted by some bias or some agenda.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And the definition I landed on is actually not of my own invention. It came from the International Energy Agency, who I viewed as an impartial player in advising governments and industries. And they wrote a seminal study in 2017 on the impact of digital on energy. And their definition is that something which is digital must bring together three underlying capabilities. It must generate data. It must have some kind of analytic capability or computational horsepower, and some sort of underlying communications to share the data and the results of the analytics with other similar devices or services or products out there. And underpinning that is the rapid growth in chipsets and their capacities to store data and provide horsepower and handle communication volumes. Those three things are themselves growing exponentially. And then you combine them together and you create something which is itself growing exponentially. The easiest way to look at it, when I'm on stage presenting to audiences, is I just point to my watch or my smartphone. These things have data. They can do mathematics and calculations, and they're equipped with lots of communications abilities. And those three things taken together allow a product, a service, a thing to participate in a digital world. And that's this definition of digital, if you want to think about it in those terms.
Wow, that's fascinating. And that really gives some clear context about what we're talking about here.
Yeah. And it's the tricky bit here is the underlying chipsets, the chips that are behind this. They have fallen in cost to a point where they are now giveaways. And the same chipsets are being used to fuel data storage, analytics, and communications. And so in my world, in the oil and gas world, we used to think about computational horsepower as being a constraint. There just was never enough of it. Now we have access to unlimited quantities of it. So we've shifted from a world of constraint to a world of superabundance. Not abundance, superabundance. And that changes how you think about your business models and the context within which you operate.
And Jeffrey, I think it's so interesting, like as Jonathan mentioned, this idea of digital can mean, and digital transformation can mean so many things to so many different people. In fact, you know, as you mentioned, you started the first chapter of your book by defining digital, but I'm very interested in this idea that I've never heard before, and that is of a biased definition of digital. That insight, that's interesting, and I'm going to have to think through that a little bit more. That's a very interesting point.
Yeah, it's all about follow the money, and
yeah.
if someone's being someone's being paid and motivated for their money tree to position digital in a certain fashion, they'll be highly motivated to do so. And they wouldn't be wrong, but there's definitely a bias there.
Incentives matter.
Absolutely.
Yeah, right. Yep. So, Jeffrey, then, you know, I know from studying your work that you have a proven framework for approaching digital. Could you walk our listeners through that framework from a high level, please?
For sure. So imagine a layer cake. Well, everyone loves cake. I love cake. imagine a layer cake with multiple layers. And imagine you've got this big central layer of your cake. And that layer is, and these layers, I'll give them names. So the top layer is digital capability. And the middle layer is digital core. And the bottom layer is digital foundations. And a company that's going to be doing and being successful in digital transformation has to do all three of those layers. The two middle layers of this cake, you can buy. But if you want to be digital, there's a big distinction. You have to do the top layer of the cake. And most of the businesses dispense with the top layer and just buy digital and think that they're done. And it's just simply not sufficient. And let's dig into this beautiful, delicious layer cake. So the middle layer is what I call is the digital core. And the digital core is where companies create what I call signature ways of business. It's the combination of a company or a department or a team's quite specific data assets coupled with sensors or devices that generate that data and computational ability, machine learning, or artificial intelligence to interpret that data, and then robots or autonomous processes to then execute that real work using the results of that computation and the data analysis. Mm-hmm. So your data core, your digital core, is made up of those four things: data generated by things, interpreted by machines, and acted on by robots. And companies and businesses and teams configure and reconfigure this digital core, the signature ways of doing business, over and over again to create value. So you can be an Internet of Things business, but if you bolt your thing to the deep understanding of the data that your things generate, and you feed it into a machine so that it can interpret the data, you create outsized value. And you can see this in Tesla's cars. The cars are lots of sensors to generate data and lots of machines to interpret the data, and soon the car will be robotic and it will be more or less autonomous. That creates extraordinary value, and you can see it in Tesla's stock price, up 800% last year.
Yeah, right.
So there's layer one of your cake, and if you just consumed one layer of the cake, you're in this layer. But like all good cakes, you need a second layer. The bottom layer is what I call digital foundations, and the digital foundations are made up of cloud computing, trust technologies, and enterprise capabilities. And the cloud computing is what stitches together the things and the data sets and the robots so that they can share information with each other. It's critical. And you can see cloud computing is just staggeringly how fast it's growing. And then beneath that is trust technologies, not as used yet, but coming very, very quickly. And this relates to blockchain, Bitcoin, and various other trust tools. And then finally, on the very, very bottom of the cake are the enterprise tools, the enterprise resource planning tools, the cyber tools, the stuff that you need to run your business. These are themselves going digital and becoming digital, and you need them. So there's your bottom layer of your cake. You could have those two layers of the cake. You can buy digital. But as they say, if you want to be digital, you have to have the top layer of the cake. And the top layer of the cake is the really hard part. It's where we create people-based change in embracing digital. We have to adopt new ways of working. And these are driven by two laws. The first law is Moore's law, viral change. So things are changing so fast. In business terms, Moore's law translates to 40% compounded annual growth rate. Now, if we grow anything by 2 or 3% industrially, we feel pretty good. Imagine something that grows 40% compounded, and it does that for long periods of time. That's the key driver for digital, is how fast it's changing. And so to work with that, we have to embrace different ways of working because digital is changing at a pace that most of us can't cope with. So therefore, we need to adopt agile ways of working, a much sharper understanding of user experience, being far more nimble and agile, and that's ways of working change. And then above that, the very top of the layer of cake, as I characterize it, is people and change management, getting the right talents, the right skill set, the right people, and helping those individuals in the organization embrace change. And unless you build that, what I call the digital capability, unless you've got that, you will really struggle to keep pace with the drivers of change at the next two layers down in your cake, data and Internet of Things and machine learning and blockchain. They're just changing way too fast. So to be digital at the top of the cake, you have to embrace these new digital capabilities.
Very interesting way of looking at it, Jeffrey. I'm going to write a paper on this cake. It's fascinating.
But, layered cake.
Yeah, it's layered cake. Yeah, exactly. And you know, the way I often look at it, you know, we call it the triad, people, processes, and technology. You know, and I think the way the way you broke it down is very meaningful and very insightful. But just for our listeners, again, if I may, your cake, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's really a four-layer cake, correct? You have your...
Let's see.
Is it three or four layers?
I see it as digital capability is your top layer, which it breaks down into two sub-layers, if you like. People,
your core and foundation.
Agile methods, yeah, exactly. And then your middle is your digital core, and it has four components, which you combine and recombine to solve for real work. And your digital foundations are sitting on things like cloud computing, trust technologies, and enterprise capabilities. So the cake, if you think about it in a model, the cake is three layers. The layers themselves break down into different sub-layers. So it's probably more than three, but three is how I used to try and get people to really understand the distinction between being digital and buying digital. You can't be digital unless you have all three of those layers working with you.
Absolutely.
That's the key message there. Yeah.
Yeah. Great message. Great point.
Jeffrey, I think this is fantastic. The distinction between buying digital and being digital, I think, is something that is really not clear. And you've just made it incredibly clear. So thank you for that.
Yeah, I've seen this endemic to industry. It's specific to oil and gas, and I don't have enough experience in many other industries to be sharp on this. And I can absolutely tell you that when you're in an industry that's running at pace the way oil and gas is these days, that people really want to buy their way out of their problems. But the secret here, unfortunately, is you're going to have to change the nuts and bolts of the business in more fundamental ways, and that means people. And that's really hard to do.
Yeah. I mean, I live and work on the people and the change strategy side of this, you know, helping people embrace the drivers of change. And I've never seen them as actually opposing technology. And what I really like about your model is it explains how it's integrated all the way. I want to pull on that to say, you know, when you look at those three, the digital core, digital capabilities, and the digital foundation, specifically oil and gas, but also in general, where do businesses really go wrong? And where do they tend to make those mistakes that you can see?
Well, the first is an underplay on the value of data. So oil and gas companies are very, very data-rich businesses because, the product is dangerous. Like, you don't even want to be exposed to it. So, you know, the business runs almost entirely on information that it has about fossil fuels, because we don't want to come into contact with the fossil fuel directly. So it's a very interesting thought, you know. No one ever descends down the oil well to inspect the inventory of gas down there physically. Like, you can go into a wine cellar and count bottles, but you can't go into the oil and gas reservoir and inspect the holdings. So we're running this industry entirely on data that we have about the industry. So data, therefore, is really, really important to oil and gas. And yet, when you dig underneath it, what you find is that the industry does not actually have a data culture in the same way that you would find in a digital company. And even the job. So if you went to just 2 years ago in oil and gas, if you said, I'd like to meet with the data scientist of your oil company, people would look at you like you've got two heads. Like, well, what are you talking about? We don't have that. But the reality is, the data is the lifeblood of digital. Without that, you can't really, like, imagine start adding sensors to your equipment. They're going to start spewing data. And if you don't really think carefully, how are you going to clean that data, remove the anomalies, make it accessible, give it context, store it correctly, make it accessible, allow people to work with it? Like, unless you think your way through that, that's your first breakdown.
Yeah.
Second big breakdown after that is where people really struggle, is that they simply don't bother with changing the business to keep pace with the change of the technology. it's always worked this way. We've always done our work in this fashion. Why would we change? And that's just a lack of understanding of the imperative here driven by the Moore's Law.
Well, I think, Jeffrey, that might lead us into my next question. And maybe that second point has something to do with this idea of what you call fuse and bang. You know, so I know in your speaking engagements, you mentioned this fuse and bang, the timing and impacts of digital. Can you explain to our listeners what you mean by that? And perhaps that's one way to sell the organization on, you know, this idea of the importance of staying on pace and making that investment in digital.
So those of us who are of a certain age, and I'll put my hand up because I am, I remember watching cartoons from Bugs Bunny and Wile E. Coyote, Elmer Fudd, and Yosemite Sam. You guys are laughing, so you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Imagine that cartoon where, you know, Bugs Bunny is in some sort of contrived altercation with Yosemite Sam. And the altercation involves a comically large keg of gunpowder, which is somehow jammed into Yosemite Sam's backside. And he's racing off, leaving a trail of gunpowder on the gangplank or the deck of the ship or wherever they happen to be. Bugs merely drops a match onto that gunpowder fuse, and the fuse then goes racing after Yosemite Sam. And it always ends in this comically large, epic, but not very terminal explosion, because he'll be back the very next scene to do it all over again.
Mm-hmm.
So the right. bang is the size of that keg of gunpowder, and the fuse is how long the trail is of that gunpowder before it reaches the keg and explodes. And so the analogy in digital is that some industries have a long fuse, like it'll take quite a while before these digital tools start to have an effect. And the bang may be small or may be large. Let me use an example of a long fuse, slow bang problem in oil and gas. You take an oil refinery, it was built 40 years ago. It does not have the sensor technologies built into it, lacks conduit, might not even have necessary wiring. And the idea that you're somehow going to turn that into a digital animal to rival Tesla's cars is just laughable. It's just not going to happen. And so the fuse is very, very long before you're going to see any change. And then when the change arrives, it may be quite small.
Mm.
Whereas let's think about a big bang and a short fuse. So imagine you're a technology company, you're a service company, a rig company, as an example, you're drilling rigs. You've got on your rig the ability to collect data from sensors at the drill bit. And every 2 or 3 years, your rigs are so beat up because of how hard this job is, you replace your rigs. Well, every 3 years, you've got a window to incorporate all kinds of new technology. Remember that Moore's Law is changing at a 40% compounded annual growth rate. So 3 years from now, if you bought a rig today, 3 years from now, your rig has the potential to embed on it a dramatically different suite of technologies. And sure enough, if you look at the services industry, the degree of change in that industry is far outstripping what you would see in general oil and gas, because the capital turns over fast. Capital isn't huge. Drill rigs aren't that expensive. And the ability to incorporate these technologies in is far easier than for, say, a big oil refinery that, you know, doesn't change except every 40 years. So the fuse for them is really quite short. And I can tell you, when you start staring at drill rigs, there are a number of companies trying to figure out, how do I go from a 32-person crew down to a 2-person crew? That's a big bang. That changes all kinds of stuff for a whole lot of people when you can do that. So in that industry, short fuse, big bang.
Interesting.
Jeffrey, this is fascinating.
Let me just sort of tailor that a little bit. What I did in the book is I looked at every segment of the industry, upstream, midstream, downstream, turnarounds, capital projects, trading, retailing, even back office functions, and just asked the same question. What is the length of the fuse? In other words, how much time do we have before these technologies will have an impact? And then when they do arrive, what's the impact actually going to be on that part of the value chain? And the book maps out a little chart series, how to think about that. If you kind of distill it down, it says, if you're at the front end where your capital turns over quickly, technology companies, services companies, field services outfits, you're going to be feeling this far faster than, say, someone who's running an oil refinery because of the nature of capital. And so imagine the curve. And what I tell people who are selling to oil and gas is appreciate that your message that, hey, I got this whizzy, you know, this capability to do this, and it fits really well in, say, oil refineries. Guess what? You might have a long struggle to try and get them to see the value of that because it changes so slowly. Take that technology instead to a drill operator. They'd be far more interested in innovation because they have the ability to cycle their capital so much better. That's how you think about the fuse and the bang model.
Fascinating, right? It really helps me identify, based on capital turnover, where to really focus and expect to see digital innovation. And it's a perfect segue here, because ultimately the fuse and the bang tells us where we're likely to see and what impact. But I want to focus on what would you say that the ultimate impact of being digital is for a company and its effect on its value chain?
Well, unfortunately, in oil and gas, there are very few companies yet who have taken the step to distinguish themselves in the way the digital companies distinguish themselves. And I'll just ask the question, can you think or name a single oil company who introduces themselves as, we are a digital company that happens to produce oil? No, all oil companies that happen to use digital. And so therefore, they are not being digital. They're just buyers of digital. So I'm still waiting. In fact, I have a whole keynote address that says delivered to oil and gas audiences, that energy is transitioning, the future is being built, but we can build the future. The incumbents in this industry are actually best positioned to lead that energy world of the future. And so there's an opportunity to be the true heroes, to both marshal our way through these ESG challenges and the digital transformation. But unless this industry gets its act together, it's not going to happen. To the question, I can't point to any companies that I would signal as being sort of market leaders, certainly on the oil company side. There are some suppliers to oil and gas, though, that are extraordinary in how they have transformed themselves. A company called Solar Turbines is a good example. I think it's a Caterpillar subsidiary. But in 2005, 2006, they said, you know what, the world's changing. We need to change differently. We need to take our turbine technology and make it a lot smarter and a lot sort of self-correcting and self-diagnosing. And they have been investing hugely and reinventing their company. You go to their site and you look at the software releases that they're doing. Honestly, they look like they're Amazon. That's how fast they're moving. Wow. That's a company that gets it. But they're a turbine company. They're way up on the curve on the tech side. They've had to change. They're not actually the actual oil industry companies themselves directly.
So, Jeffrey, I'd like to, I know you've alluded to this, but I think it's an important point, and I'd like to reiterate for our listeners, from your perspective, industry aside, when it comes to successful digital transformation, what would you say are some of the key implementation challenges? If you could just give me, you know, three or four main challenges, what would you say those are? How would you itemize those challenges?
Well, first challenge is that this is a people change initiative, not a technology change initiative. So mm-hmm. There's challenge number one. Challenge number two is that the range of opportunity to target energy for digital transformation is almost unlimited because the oil and gas, in particular energy, probably secondarily, is behind the curve. So there's lots of targets to shoot at. Deciding where to shoot, where to place your bets is really hard. Third major challenge that I see is that companies often don't understand precisely where and how they create value. And as a result, their digital initiatives look and feel a little bit like science projects. And what the industry needs to do is be much sharper, take very clear aim at real business problems, not some hunch or assumption or hypothesis, but take hard aim at a real business problem. And the fourth thing that I see is a key challenge is that while the pandemic has shown oil and gas and energy companies how fast they can change, it hasn't yet convinced people that they should change. It just says, well, when push comes to shove, we can change fast like everybody else. But the digital initiatives will fall onto deaf ears if the employees themselves don't understand why they need to be doing this. And so there's a digital awareness requirement here to get their capability to a level where when you say, okay, we're going to be using our trial and augmented reality to do this, the employees don't look at it like, oh, you're wasting my time with toys. They actually can say, oh, I've had some training on this. I understand why you would want to do this. And then they pitch in and want to help. But unless you get the ground laid for this, a lot of this effort will fall apart.
Yeah, good points. And I think really what you're saying is the digital needs to be aligned with the strategy, right? I mean, that's a...
Completely, yeah.
That's saying an awful lot there, and that means a lot of things, but it's really important that the purpose of your digital is really aligned with your purpose and your strategy as an organization, and that people understand what that is. So,
exactly. That's not rocket science, but it's quite elusive.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's a great point that a lot of times is maybe underemphasized and undervalued during a digital transformation. So great points.
Yeah. And following that, digital needs to be aligned with strategy, and there's all sorts of reasons why it doesn't, from my perspective. Mm-hmm. So Jeffrey, how do you counter or address those challenges when you're working with oil and gas and industry in general? What's your approach to this?
Well, I've characterized it in my book as I try and put my arms around this. But my advice to those organizations is to be digital. There is a clear requirement to culturally move the organization forward, and in terms of culture change, and that needs to be a clear and explicit goal for the company, which means it becomes it's agenda altering, is what someone once said to me. If I do that, I'm going to alter all the other agendas in my organization. And my message is, yes, that's exactly what you're doing. You're going to have to alter other agendas. As an example, you can imagine one manager's got some sort of digital initiative they're trying to drive, but they need a little bit of Joey's time from that department and Mary's time from over there, and they can't get it because the managers for Joey and Mary are like, no, I'm not doing that. Not interested in that this year. It's not part of my goals. This digital works when you stretch it across these companies. And to do that, it means unwinding and challenging some of these organizational structural barriers that block this kind of innovation.
So if I'm hearing you right, Jeffrey, then the scope here and one of the potentials to address this in being digital is to actually include culture in the scale of the transformation you're trying to achieve. Is that right?
Yes, exactly right. Exactly right. And I use a good example from oil and gas because it's my sort of touchstone, my home base, if you like. But the oil and gas world builds things using a waterfall method of design. So you see the engineers get together and they think about what the thing should do that they want to build, and they do a lot of work. And then they hand it over to another group and they do a lot of work, and then the next group and it does a lot of work. It takes forever. Where in the digital world, they will establish, here's the amount of time I have to work on my problem, and I'm going to deliver something within this time box. So instead of binding it by scope, I'm going to bind it by time. And then I'm going to work very, very closely with counterparts and colleagues to zero in on what it is that I'm trying to accomplish. And then I'm going to iteratively develop and design my way to that outcome. And that could be a well pad. And it doesn't have to be a software. It could be something else. Yeah,
right.
Absolutely. And that agile way of doing things is so foreign to this industry that you have to undo decades and decades of programming and education and behavior and incentive structures and supply chain rigidities so that you can begin to behave in a more agile way. That's a lot of work, and it's mostly people. It's not driven by cement and steel.
Yeah, so true. So, Jeffrey, I'd like to maybe just slightly switch gears. I have a question on a specific digital technology, but just briefly, if possible, because I know it's a pretty loaded technology and question, but can you provide our listeners with a quick lesson on blockchain, which you call, quote, the new engine of trust? That is, what is it, and where do you see its greatest potential in terms of the value chain in general?
So I try to describe blockchain by using an example to make it more real for people. So, Jack, let's imagine you're a buyer and I'm a seller. And you're buying, what you put out your purchase order to buy something, and the purchase order will have the quantity you want and the description of your app, maybe the part number that you're after, the price you wish to pay, the extension, the taxation, and so on. So you have your purchase order. I receive your purchase order, and then I create on my side a sales order. And my sales order will have much of the same data, actually. Your name, what product you want to buy, how many parts, bits and pieces you expect to buy, the price we've agreed, the date it's going to be delivered. So what you've created is, and your data, your purchase orders, you might put those into a table, almost as you can imagine, spreadsheet, rows and columns of all that data. I create a similar spreadsheet on my side, and except I call it different, something different. I call it sales, you call it purchases. Those are ledgers. Now, what would happen if we could create a shared ledger, instead of you having your separate ledger and I have my separate ledger, with data that mostly matches, sometimes it's different, mostly matches. What if we could create a shared ledger which contained data that we both agree was correct? Now, that shared ledger means that you can relieve from your side, your business, the costs associated with dealing with the disputes and the arguments with me on my side, because I happen to have different data in my ledger than what was in your ledger, because we have a shared ledger. What blockchain does, blockchain is a database structure that creates the shared ledger between these two counterparties who don't trust each other. I mean, I've got every incentive on my side. You know, if you said, well, I want to buy 12 of those, well, I'm going to put down 13, because you know what? He always asks for 13. Every time I sell to him, he wants 13. I'm going to put 13 in there. Right. My ledger is now different from your ledger. Yeah, exactly. Here's an interesting statistic. Did you know that 9% of all the oil traded by ships on the oceans today, fully 9% is disputed? The party who is selling the oil and the party who is buying the oil don't agree on what they agreed to buy and sell.
You said 9%?
9%. Wow. 9%.
And 9%. That's a big dollar number. Yeah.
You do the math in your head. How much oil is traded on ships per year? It's something like 40%. The balance is others, pipelines. But say 40% of 100 million barrels a day. Multiply that by 365 days a year. Multiply that by $55 a barrel. Multiply that by 120 days to settle a dispute. You end up with a very, very, very large number.
Big number. Yeah, interesting.
A big number. Imagine you could create the shared ledger between the two parties that captured correct data, and you could eliminate the disputes. So that's what blockchain is. It's that shared ledger. And how it works is that it sits on multiple computers, which makes it very hard to hack and destroy and corrupt. It makes it hard to insert false data, because the two parties have to agree what's the correct data. And the database structure, if you work with trusted parties to manage and maintain the data for you, you can run these things at very, very low cost.
Yeah.
So that's just sales and purchases. Try to imagine all the places where you got two people doing a deal and they don't trust each other. It's like virtually every deal. Blockchain has the potential to underpin how you would trust doing things. So another example, European automakers are equipping the next generation of cars with blockchain capabilities so that you can drive to a parking lot, your car will talk to the gate and open up the gate to let your car in. You don't have to roll your window down and get a ticket. You just drive in, the gate closes. The database now records that your car is in that lot. And then when you leave, the gate opens and you drive out, it now records that you left that. No disputes, no tickets, nothing. It's recorded on this blockchain database structure. You can see it, I can see it, and then it just gets auto-paid. This could transform parking lots, road tolls, gasoline purchases, power purchases for your car, licensing for your vehicle, paying for insurance, paying for accidents, tickets, all kinds of things get unlocked here.
Yeah, blockchain has huge, huge potential, no doubt about that. So, Jeffrey, I know that I have one more question with our time today, and I believe Jonathan does as well, has one more question he'd like to ask. I want to switch gears again to this idea of people and culture that you referred to earlier. And you stated on your site and in your work that, quote, change is easy except for the people, end quote. And then you noted on your site something that goes for digital transformations, I feel, in all industries, and that is, quote, the hard part of digital is helping people embrace change. And then you also mentioned that, quote, the biggest challenge oil and gas companies face in addressing digital changes in the industry is equipping their people with a common base of understanding of digital. This goes back to what we were talking about earlier in the conversation. You then go on to add that without a common base of definitions, terminology, and frameworks, organizations run the risk that their digital agenda will be defined by specific vendors, which can have unintended consequences, end quote. So this goes back to the idea I mentioned earlier in the value of digital and the strategy, making sure it's aligned with corporate strategy and goals and mission and vision and values. What are the top recommendations you may have for our listeners on how to do that? You know, that is to avoid the challenges and pitfalls of this idea that, that change is easy except for the people.
Mm-hmm. Well, specifically on equipping the troops with your team with the common base of understanding. The reason to do that is because people are curious about this technology. They can see it all around them. And whether you like, whether you motivate it or not, people are trying to teach themselves what digital actually means. And they may be going to inappropriate places to draw conclusions about that. If your employees' only education around digital is social media tools in the over the last 4 years dealing with false narratives, fake news, and the challenges of Facebook in the court systems, threats of breakup, your people will have a very jaundiced view, a jaded view about what digital is and what it could do for your business. You could successfully inoculate your people from ever embracing this because they have been miseducated about what digital actually is. So I put that out there because what I believe is unless you counterbalance that, you definitely run the risk you will have an ill-equipped workforce for your change agenda.
Yeah.
Now, how good do point. You solve for that? Petronas is a big Malaysian oil and gas concern, 50,000 employees, and they've created an internal team whose role is to scour the planet to look for the best and least expensive but thoughtful ways that they can get their employees up to speed quickly on digital. Then they encourage their employees to take these courses, and the employees get reimbursed on completion. And you know, the pressure to take the courses is pretty high, as you can appreciate. So what they're doing is creating this incentive structure for the employees not to go to Facebook and get educated about, like, God knows what Facebook would tell you about digital, but go instead to this recommended training course or this awareness course. That's what I counsel companies to do is don't leave this to chance. You will create problems with your employee base.
Exactly. Don't leave it to chance. That's the key. It's not worth it.
It's not worth it. Yeah. And I like this notion of, because we're rated on Virus World, right? Imagine inoculating your employees against a successful digital deployment. So you have a team over here. their job is to roll this out. And by allowing your troops to self-inoculate with the wrong the wrong medicine, you've created the conditions where they cannot absorb what you want them to take on board.
Another great analogy, Jeffrey. That's right up there with the cake. So I'll have to borrow those two.
Inject some cake.
Jeffrey, I love that that analogy. Inoculating yourself against a successful digital transformation.
Yeah.
In conclusion of this conversation, which I've found fascinating, I want to distill down because your analogies are perfect distillations of your experience, your wisdom, your research in this field. How would you approach our listeners and our fellow practitioners who are listening and business leaders? What would you say is the key thing for them to see, do, or be to lead a successful digital transformation in about two sentences or less? What would that one sort of key bit be on see, do, and be?
You're being challenged, Jeffrey. That's a loaded question.
Well, it is, but I have an analogy or at least a story to tell about it. A company called Texmark Chemicals in Houston, I hold out as the textbook example of what they did. They took their, probably I'm not sure what the right word is, their crustiest and cynical engineer team and took them on a road trip to Hewlett-Packard. Now, this is a group who said, on no way, this stuff is toys. This is stuff for my grandkids or my kids. Not investing in this for our business. They took them to HP's labs, and HP showed them what some of this stuff could do. And they came out the other end totally switched on about the power of this. This is a show-me industry. You got to show people this can actually work. If you want to get started, I tell people, get on the road. Go find leaders in, not necessarily your industry, but go find the leaders in an industry that are signaling that they are far out ahead because of their innovation. Go see what they're up to. You'd be surprised what you can learn, and you can get your people to go, whoa, well, we could do that too.
Excellent advice. Excellent answer, Jeffrey.
Eloquent, short, and meaningful. I love it.
So, Jeffrey, thank you so much for your time today. You're such a fun teacher. You're a dynamic and inspiring speaker for sure, and your passion is obvious. So thanks again for joining us today and sharing your insight. We appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thanks again, and be well.
Thank you very much. What a great conversation, Jeffrey.
Thank you. Bye for now.
Thank you for joining us for today's episode of the ERP OCJ podcast. This podcast is intended as a forum to study, share, and discuss ERP organizational change successes and challenges. We discuss the people, process, and technological components of ERP organizational change by drawing on knowledge from extensive research, collaborative learning, and practitioner expertise and experience. We are incredibly grateful to have friends, colleagues, and mentors join us in our podcast as we seek to promote, connect, and foster relationships in the ERP organizational change community and contribute to its success by bringing research and practice closer together. We want to make sure this is the most useful and insightful ERP podcast you listen to, and we'd love your help in doing so by leaving us feedback and a review. A great place to do so is at Apple Podcasts. Just click on the Listen in Apple Podcasts link, then click Ratings and Reviews, and let us know your thoughts. You can get more info about the show, including show notes and episode highlights for this and all of our episodes, by visiting nesselandassociates.com and clicking the podcast option. Please join us again next week as we discuss the latest ERP organizational change research, practice, and stories. And don't forget to follow us on social media, hashtag the ERP OCJ. Thanks again for listening. Have a fantastic week.